The state of Iowa just passed what's being called the most restrictive abortion law in the country. Here's Governor Kim Reynolds on All Things Considered.
This is bigger than just a law. This is about life. And I'm not going to back down from who I am or what I believe in.
What does this mean for women in Illinois living on the border? Plus, you might be hoping to get outside now that winter's finally over. In Illinois, there's perhaps no better destination than Starved Rock State Park. But it's gotten so popular that park officials are having a hard time maintaining it. Here's Site Superintendent Carrie Novak.
It's a great feeling to know that this place is so popular and people obviously enjoy it and want to come back and everything like that. It's frustrating when you see the amount of use the place gets and, you know, the wear and the tear.
Novak says 10.4 million people have visited in the last 5 years. We'll hear about that, along with some other outdoor recommendations a little off the beaten path. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Late last week, our neighbors to the west in Iowa signed into law one of the country's most restrictive abortion bills. This so-called heartbeat legislation bans abortions once a fetal heartbeat has been detected, which is at about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Compare that to here in Illinois, where a fetus is considered viable at around 23 to 24 weeks of gestation, and abortions are legal up until that point, except in cases where the mother's life is at risk. The law, which is set to go into effect in July, will likely be challenged in court. But what impact will that have, both on women in Iowa and here in Illinois? We know that many women come here to Illinois to get abortions, as our laws are much less restrictive, especially when compared to many of our neighboring states. But if you're in the western part of Illinois, sometimes it can be, up until this point, it's been easier to obtain abortions, perhaps in Iowa. Now that the law is changing, so too might their options. We've got a couple of folks here to discuss this issue now, starting with Katarina Sostarek, who's been reporting on this new legislation for Iowa Public Radio. She's on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Katarina. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Also on the line from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago is lawyer and professor of medical humanities and bioethics, Katie Watson. She joined us recently to talk about her new book, Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Katie, thanks for being here. Welcome back.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And with us in our studios in Evanston at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism is Sharon Lau, the Director of Clinical Services at Whole Women's Health. They're a nationwide operator of clinics for women that provide comprehensive care, which includes abortions, and they operate, their Illinois clinic is actually in Peoria. Sharon, thanks for being with me, too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Katarina, can we start with you just before we get to the ramifications of all of this? Because I imagine a lot of our listeners aren't following Iowa politics as closely here. This bill passed. If you can just walk us through what happened. It passed the State House and the Senate early last week, and it landed on Governor Reynolds' desk. What was the Democratic involvement like with this bill, and was it a surprise that it passed?
It was a bit of a surprise. No Democrats voted for the bill. The Senate, the Iowa Senate, had passed this bill earlier in the legislative session a couple months ago. And after that, it seemed like the House of Representatives really was not interested in taking up the bill. And then all of a sudden, in this last week of the legislative session, which was last week, the House rounded up 51 votes to pass it. It's a 100-member chamber, so they really just got over the line there. A few Republicans voted against it. And after that, they sent it to the Senate, and all of that happened in one day. So they went late into the night voting at 2 in the morning, and then 3 days later, the governor signed it.
And I know you spoke with Republican Representative Sandy Salmon about this issue. Let's hear what they had to, what she had to say.
And we need to be on the right side of history. And even better than that, we need to be part of making good history happen. And with this bill, we do that. With this bill, we make Iowa one of the safest places for the baby in the womb in the entire nation. With this bill, we thrust Iowa into the forefront of making good history happen, both here and in our nation.
That's Iowa Representative Sandy Salmon, a Republican. It sounds like, Katarina, from that speech, that sounds like, I imagine, as is with the case with lots of conversations about abortion in legislature, it sounded like it was a really impassioned debate that probably happened on the floor.
It was. That House debate lasted 9 hours. Very passionate arguments and personal stories on both sides.
And what's changing for women, Katerina? Can you tell us what the laws are right now in Iowa regarding abortion?
So as of last year, Iowa bans abortions after 20 weeks into a pregnancy. The exceptions are to preserve the life of the mother or to prevent irreversible damage to a major bodily function. So that's in effect right now. Last year, the legislature also put a 3-day waiting period to get an abortion. That's currently on hold. There is a lawsuit in the Iowa Supreme Court, and they still haven't ruled on that.
Katie Watson, I wonder if you could weigh in here as a lawyer and someone who teaches bioethics at Northwestern and is an expert on this issue. What can you just let us know what the law is in Illinois regarding abortions?
Yes. So the most important law is the law that the Supreme Court has established, because the right to end a pregnancy is a constitutional right. So it's not completely up to the states to draw these lines. And so the most important point is this patchwork idea. The Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Pennsylvania said states may not ban abortion before what's called viability, meaning that a fetus has a reasonable chance of survival and having a, quote, meaningful life outside of the womb. Right now, that's put at about 24 weeks. So it's unconstitutional for states to pass bans, whether it's 20 weeks, 15 weeks, 6 weeks for heartbeat. It's not up to the states. It's a constitutional right. So the law in Illinois mirrors the law of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court didn't say that states must ban abortions at viability. It said that they may, and that's what Illinois has done. So a woman may have an abortion in Illinois for whatever her reasons are, up to viability, which in a healthy pregnancy is approximately 24 weeks. Past that, if her life or health is in danger, as the Supreme Court requires and the Constitution requires, an abortion could proceed past that. But those cases are rare.
And so the question of whether or not this is constitutional, Katie, just to pose that back to you, we've seen other cases where states have tried to pass these laws and they have been ruled unconstitutional. Is that what you imagine may happen in this case?
Yes. What's particularly on point and to me sad about this law is the federal judiciary is divided into circuits. So several states all share an appellate court, and they all have to abide by that appellate court's decision. Iowa is in the Eighth Circuit. Arkansas and North Dakota are too. And in Arkansas and North Dakota also passed heartbeat bans. And in 2015, the Eighth Circuit, the same appellate court that will look at the Iowa statute, in two separate decisions ruled these are just patently unconstitutional. They clearly violate Roe versus Wade and Casey's viability standards. And I say sad because of this. This is using the law as a symbol or to, quote, send a message. When we're talking about constitutional rights, and they've already been, the Eighth Circuit has to follow these decisions. There's no reason to believe the Supreme Court would make a different decision if this was appealed up. Justice Gorsuch replaced Justice Scalia, probably going to vote similarly. So what they're doing is using the Iowa taxpayers to finance costly litigation that has a foregone conclusion. And I would love, as an ethicist, to see that money spent on helping people prevent unintended pregnancies, or better yet, the above 20% of women who say the most important reason for their abortion is because they can't afford to have a child or another child. I'd love to see the state of Iowa spend the money they're spending on this symbolic law and litigation on helping women who want to continue pregnancies to do so.
Sharon Lau, can I bring you in here with your work with the Whole Women's Health? When Katie Watson is talking about sending a message and this being symbolic, what kind of message do you think this is meant to be sent to women when women are hearing about this?
Yeah, I mean, these laws are clearly meant to prevent women from accessing care. And at that stage, most women won't even know they're pregnant, or they may be just finding out that they're pregnant. And so if they do want to seek care, they're going to have to, like you said, look to go somewhere else, travel great distances. We see patients at our clinic that come from you know, as far as 2 or 3 hours away. And so I think that's what these laws are intended to do, unfortunately, and hopefully it will be overturned.
Katerina, what are you hearing from abortion advocates in Iowa about the impact of this law being signed last week, just in terms of, obviously, again, to be clear, this isn't meant to take effect until July, but what has been the immediate reaction in Iowa?
Well, one big thing that people are worried about, Iowa has only one residency program for gynecologists and training to become gynecologists, and that could be put at risk with the passage of this law. Right now, the University of Iowa is looking at maybe opening a clinic in another state where gynecologists in training can learn certain skills that wouldn't be allowed in Iowa under this law. And basically, there's just a lot of worry about an overall decline in healthcare options for women in the state of Iowa.
Sharon, what does this look like across Illinois? When you think particularly about the clinic in Peoria, are you seeing women that come from other states?
Absolutely. We see, like I said, we see patients from Iowa, from as far away as Dubuque and Cedar Rapids. We know that folks come from Indiana quite often because of their very restrictive laws. And as well as we have a good parental judicial bypass for minors in Illinois, for minors who can't tell their parents. And so minors will come from other states to utilize that program with the ACLU as well.
Katie, what's the law in Illinois, just to Sharon's point about minors, young women?
In Illinois, minors need to notify their parents. They don't have to have their parents' consent, but they need to give them notice. And for minors who feel like that's not in their best interest, they're worried about parental abuse or that sort of thing, or they don't have a parent in their life, they can get a bypass, meaning a judge evaluates their situation and rules either that it's not in their best interest to notify their parent, it's only one parent, or that it is that they're mature enough to make this decision on their own.
Katie, as I mentioned to our audience, or you've talked to us previously about your book and your most recent book and your research on the issue of abortion. It's called Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. In your research, did you find that women do tend to travel sometimes very long distances to get an abortion? Does it seem that laws in different states make a difference?
I didn't study that personally, but I cite to research and have certainly read research that suggests that's the case. Another problem with that is it becomes a class issue, right? Because some women have the finances to travel and some don't. Or for some, that the money that they will spend to travel, because people really will scrape to the bottom of the barrel to effectuate the decision that they've made, means that it will cost them more in their lives, that they have to choose between paying their rent and getting the medical care that they need to end a pregnancy. So yes, women do travel long distances, and we certainly see that in Illinois, that women from surrounding states with more restrictive laws come to Illinois for the procedure. But think of that as another version of the female tax, right? That it costs more to exercise your constitutional rights. So if we said, oh, sure, you have a constitutional right to vote, but there's only one polling place and it's you have to have a 3-day wait and all these restrictions, so you really have to travel to another state to vote, we wouldn't really consider that much of a constitutional right. But the abortion right has been so burdened by these restrictions. It's also the case, I just want to point out on the patchwork theme, we've certainly seen 20-week restrictions and bans, and Iowa has one of those, and that's not what we're talking about today. But I just want to point out, several of those that have been challenged in court have been struck as unconstitutional because they violate Roe versus Wade and the constitutional right as well. Many of the ones that are still standing because there's no physicians in the state that do terminations past 20 weeks. So there's no plaintiff. It practically is irrelevant. But it creates this, quote, symbolism and creates confusion that somehow states get to make up their own abortion laws, when really from a constitutional perspective, that's not the case.
Katie, can you just clear up for us that 20-week, what you're talking about in specifically there in regards to Iowa?
Sure. So Iowa has a 20-week ban. I don't know the details of this situation, but I know that in other states, when those bans have not been challenged, if they've been left on the books, typically it's because no one is doing abortions over 20 weeks in that state. So there's no reason to bring a lawsuit, that the law didn't change anything. It was just symbolic. Just over 1% of abortions happen at that stage. So it's not that common in terms of physicians doing them. So I just wanted to clarify any confusion that states get to make up their own abortion laws in terms of when to stop doing them. And that's why the Iowa law will be struck down in court and why I think it's a waste of the taxpayers' money.
That's Katie Watson. Katerina Sostark is also with us from Iowa Public Radio. Katerina, we just have about a minute before we take a break, but I just wanted to ask you quickly what symbolically Republicans versus Democrats and folks in Iowa are feeling about this law. Are you hearing that it is very conflicted, or is there a lot of support?
It is very conflicted. Some Republican lawmakers who are very much in favor of this law say that they do want this to be challenged in court. They want it to challenge Roe v. Wade, which, of course, was the decision that legalized a woman's right to an abortion. And Democrats on the other side are saying this is, you know, a waste of taxpayer money because it will go to court and that it will put women's health in danger.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. Katerina Sostark is with us from Des Moines and Iowa Public Radio. Katie Watson's on the line in Chicago, where she teaches at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Bioethics. Also on the line from Evanston, Sharon Lau is with us. She's the Director of Clinical Services for Whole Women's Health. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Iowa's new abortion law that was just signed by its governor, Kim Reynolds, last week. We've been talking about that with Iowa Public Radio's Katerina Sostark. On the line from Chicago in Evanston, we have Katie Watson and Sharon Lau with us as well discussing this issue. Katie Watson, can I ask you about the legal side of this, just to follow up on a point that Katerina made right before the break? She said that there are Republican lawmakers in Iowa who see this as a viable challenge to Roe versus Wade. Legally, does that make sense?
Well, as I said, Justice Gorsuch replaced Scalia and they would vote similarly. So at the moment, there's no reason to believe that this statute would provide that vehicle. If the composition of the court changed radically in the coming year, let's say, that is possible, but it's at the moment it's not the case.
And to the point of doctors, Sharon, can I ask you what the landscape looks like across Illinois, first of all, in terms of the number of doctors who are abortion providers? What does that look like?
Well, in a rural area like Peoria, it's challenging. Our doctors there come from farther away sometimes than the patients do. It can be a challenge to get doctors in rural areas because of safety concerns with protesting and picketing, and they feel more singled out and don't have support. One of the other major issues is that a lot of the doctors locally are affiliated with a religious Catholic hospital, and so they're actually not allowed to do this work. And so that can be a big barrier to access in the rural areas.
And what do you find outside of the Chicago region? Do you have a sense of how far patients are? We've been talking about people traveling, coming into Illinois. What about people traveling throughout Illinois? Does that happen a lot as well?
It does. And I think that is often an access issue to do with when patients are able to get appointments. Different clinics go to different gestational ages. And so patients will have to travel. If, for instance, they're too far along for a clinic that might be closer, then they might have to travel a farther distance.
Kitty, as we think about this issue, I'm just thinking back to your book, Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. And I just want to ask you just about that term that you use in your book, ordinary abortion. Can you give us a sense of the number of abortions that are happening in the U.S. today, not just in Illinois, but just kind of the average for Americans?
In the United States, the most recent statistics are that just under a million pregnancies are ending in induced abortion, so intentional abortion, every year. So about 19% of all pregnancies end in abortion, and of an unintended pregnancy, I believe the number is about 42% of women and couples choose abortion to end those. So in my book, I talked about sort of the most quote-unquote average reasons and average experiences of people choosing abortion.
And of those, you said that some of them, more than 20% of women said not being able to afford a baby was a reason for why they had an abortion?
Yes, and one extensive data collection of women sitting in the waiting rooms of abortion clinics asked, what are the reasons you're having an abortion? And women were allowed to check off more than one reason. 73% checked off not able to afford a baby right now as a reason. 23% said it was the most important reason. So I think sometimes we forget that many women are making decisions that are economic decisions. And so it's interesting connecting all our economic political issues with our reproductive issues, I think from both a quote pro-life and quote pro-choice side might be interesting and helpful if we really care about the women who are making these decisions.
And Kitty, as a lawyer who studies this issue, and as we're talking about this issue as how it's been brought up in Iowa within the state legislature, do you have a sense that lawmakers connect those dots that you just did?
I don't, not always, and rarely. So I think in politics, often the point is to score the point. You know, it's sort of that political football that I need the headline today. I voted in this way. I think it's harder, and it takes a lot of strength and integrity and long-term planning to say, here's my vision of social justice. If your vision of social justice includes reducing the destruction of embryos, what is most likely to bring that about? Is it a ban like this, or would there be other social programs that would lead to that result if that was your goal? And so I think in politics, sometimes it's harder or people don't take the time to do those longer-term programs, and it makes me wonder what their true goals are sometimes. The ethics of the heartbeat bans are another thing we could talk about that are interesting to me as an ethicist.
Right. And before we get to that, can I just ask you, Katerina, just the politics of this, just to focus on that for a moment, what are the politics as it stands right now in Iowa in terms of this law has been passed, it's set to take effect in July? Have there already been some legal challenges that have happened?
Not yet, but Planned Parenthood and the ACLU have already said that they will file a lawsuit. They have some time because the law goes into effect July 1st. We don't know if it'll be in state or federal court yet.
And to that point, Katie, of this, because I think a lot of people have heard the headline of it being a heartbeat ban, can you just explain a little bit of what that means in terms of how you understand it?
Sure. So in Roe versus Wade, the court set viability. And what that means is a fetus, if it was outside of the womb, could breathe independently, either with a ventilator or on its own, wouldn't be dependent on the woman's body. This law moves that conceptually. It doesn't say if embryo is viable when you first see a heartbeat. It moves the entire concept to say it's not lung development that matters, it's a heartbeat that matters. So when a heartbeat is the first sort of organ to develop, the heart, and at first it's just a tube that contracts. So you don't hear anything, but you would see that contraction. and on a vaginal ultrasound, and that happens about 4 weeks after conception or 6 weeks after your last period. 6 weeks, that would be how it's technically dated, but you've been pregnant for 4 weeks. You can hear a heartbeat because there would be chambers, so you'd hear that beating sound maybe around 10 or 12 weeks after someone's period. So that's the idea. The thing that I think this is missing is the fact that the blood that little contraction is moving is getting oxygen from the woman's heartbeat, right? So that embryo can't survive, of course, outside of a woman's body. So it's looking at that heart, that the contraction of that heart tube in isolation. The reason that's not what is not keeping that embryo alive, it's critical for that continued development, but it's actually the woman's heartbeat that's scientifically relevant here. That is what's oxygenating her blood through her lungs, and then her lungs are getting the oxygen in the blood, and her heart is moving that blood so that the oxygen can get to the embryo and later the fetus. So I know Governor Reynolds has made the point that if we say we've declared death at when a person's heart stops beating, we should declare life when an embryo's heart starts beating. That embryo was alive before you saw that heartbeat. An embryo is alive from the moment of conception. That's cellular life. So the heartbeat isn't new in terms of being alive, and it's not the same as you or I if we were declared dead because our heart stopped beating, because that embryo lives inside a woman and can only survive inside that woman with her heart beating.
Thanks for that, Katie. It's obviously, as you're going into this, as always, it's a really complex issue to understand the nuance of it. So I appreciate you going into a little bit of that for us. That's Katie Watson. She teaches at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. I want to thank Sharon Lau for being with us as well with Whole Women's Health. Katarina Sostarek has been covering this issue for Iowa Public Radio. We'll tweet out some of her stories. Ladies, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
After a long, cold Illinois winter, at last we've got a sunny spring. Maybe that's got you starting to think about a long weekend to spend time outdoors. And did Starved Rock State Park come to mind? You're not the only one. Site Superintendent Carrie Novak recently checked in on how many people have visited Starved Rock since 2014, and the answer was 10.4 million people. All of that's taking a toll on the park's physical landscape, and we're joined now by Superintendent Carrie Novak, who's on the line from his office in Oglesby. He's a site superintendent of Starved Rock and Matheson State Parks. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Also joining us is Tom Collins, a reporter with the LaSalle News Tribune in the Illinois Valley. He's been reporting on this for the paper. Hey, Tom. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Carrie, I was struck by the way you found out about the number of visitors at Starved Rock. And in the piece that Tom wrote, you were conducting a fairly routine inspection of the trails when you saw some really big grooves that looked almost like trenches. And then you look closer and you realize, Carrie, was that because of foot traffic?
Yes. When you have, you know, a couple of million visitors, and I think last year we had, 2.7 million visitors, 2.8, and probably the majority of them are using the trails, enjoying the trails. That just puts a lot of wear and tear on them. They're, it's basically the rocks and the bluffs and everything here are sandstone, so that's a fairly fragile stone, and it does wear down.
And what other kind of impact are you seeing from the amount of traffic on the landscape of Starved Rock?
Well, the trails are getting a lot of use. The other thing is too the physical features of the trail that we've installed. For example, stairways, walkways, decks, and things like that also get a tremendous take a tremendous beating in this and require a great deal of maintenance and upkeep. And we, you know, have a couple of bridges that are closed and need to be replaced and that type of thing.
Tom, you reported on these numbers, as I mentioned, for the LaSalle News Tribune. I wonder, do you think that there's, based on your reporting, was there an anticipation of the amount of numbers that Kerry has uncovered, the 10.4 million people over the past couple of years?
You know, good question. 2 years ago, the answer would have been yes. In 2016, the National Park Service celebrated their centennial, and everyone knew that all of our state parks from coast to coast would see an increase in visits, and indeed that was the case. At the end of 2016, we thought, okay, Starved Rock had a record year. We will see the numbers retreat. They didn't. We broke 5 monthly records in 2017 and finished with a new record, just over 2.8 million. It was actually just a 2% jump from the National Parks record year in 2016. But those few thousand people make a big difference. To put this in perspective, Starved Rock outdraws all but 10 of the U.S. national parks. You know the names, Yosemite, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone. Those are the only parks in the country, 10 of them, that draw more people than Starved Rock. Our park was not meant for that type of punishment.
And Kerry, do you restrict the amount, like those parks, they're counting people coming in, they're restricting traffic. Is that something you might think about doing?
Well, we have been to the point that on weekends, when we begin filling, we start, closing lots as they come in. And we have, unfortunately, just about every weekend had to, and especially the major holidays, had to close the park for, you know, a couple hours in midday just simply because everything was full.
Wow. So, Kerry, for folks that might want to come, what's your advice to them as they're thinking about planning their trips this summer?
Hopefully they can come during the week. Monday through Friday, this is really a wonderful experience. The trails are spectacular. The views, the canyons and everything here, I think people will just love it. Try and come during the week. If you come on a weekend, you know, maybe try to get here early and be patient with us. We're doing our best.
Tom, I imagine this has also had a pretty significant economic impact on the surrounding area, the amount of folks that are coming.
It cuts both ways. It certainly has brought some money into the area. However, the village of North Utica, which is immediately located outside the Starved Rock boundaries, has not benefited directly. You would think that during a record attendance year, Utica's coffers would fill proportionally. Not quite that simple. And unfortunately for the village, there are some logistical problems created by Starved Rock's popularity. The traffic is bad. The first responders worry about being able to get to ambulance calls when Route 178 is bumper to bumper. And additionally, Utica's mostly volunteer ambulance service is needed when there's an accident at Starved Rock. And obviously, whenever the overall population or attendance increases, accidents happen. It's a lot of work for our first responders.
And Tom, is there a sense that the town is trying to hopefully add more resources, or is there an ability to do that?
It's hard to say because, the two agencies, the Department of Natural Resources and the Village of Utica, do work well together, but of course they're funded in completely different ways. Utica certainly can't, command dollars to respond to accidents that happen within park territory. Now, what I'm hearing from the people in Utica is they think the time is coming, if not already come, for there to be entrance fees. And I don't think we're talking about the types of dollars that one would have to pay at a U.S. national park, but even an admission fee of a few dollars would create a revenue stream, maybe give the staff an opportunity to do some projects and maybe even to temper the number of visits on the weekends that have become so problematic for Kerry and his overworked staff.
I want to thank Tom Collins from LaSalle News Tribune for reporting on this issue. We'll tweet out his story. Kerry Novak for joining us as well, site superintendent for Starved Rock and Matheson State Park, giving us some good advice. If you want to go this summer, do not go on the weekend. Go during the week. Thanks, gentlemen. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, we heard earlier about the huge number of visitors to Starved Rock State Park. In fact, 10.4 million people have visited in the last 4 years. And that's been taking a toll on the natural landscape of the park and has been leading park officials like Site Superintendent Carrie Novak to encourage folks to visit during the week. All this, of course, as the weather's getting warmer and certainly more people are wanting to go outside and visit some of our state's outdoor attractions. And so, if Starved Rock and even Matheson Park seem too crowded for you, what are some more off-the-beaten destinations and what can be done to make some of these popular tourist attractions a little less crowded and more manageable for everyone? Joining me now to talk about this is Nuno Ribeiro. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism at the U of I, our unofficial tour guide for lots of things in Illinois. He's here with me in our Urbana studios. Welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks
for being
here. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we get to some of your suggestions, we were just hearing earlier about Starved Rock and how it's certainly one of the most well-known tourist destinations.
The most well-known destination in the state.
And how much a risk of overcrowding it is. Do you think that's the only example, or do you think this happens at other parts of the state as well?
We have a few other examples close to the Shawnee National Forest, the Garden of the Gods, some other areas near the northwest border of the state, where Iowa also heavily visited. The Great River Roads has some periods during the year also heavily visited. But I think Starved Rock really is the prime example, just because of the sheer numbers.
And why do you think that is? Do you think it's just because we know one or two places and people, it's sort of like our Disney World. Everyone's like, let's just go there.
That's certainly part of the explanation. I think it's a combination of factors. They've become very well known. It's by far the most well-known attraction in the state. You also have an older population that is leading far healthier and more active lifestyles. So they're more likely to visit. Social media has played a role. You know, that's selfie country, right?
Right, it's Instagram land there.
It's eminently Instagrammable. You know, all those selfies with the cascading water behind you, you know, they create a desire for tourists to go. The fact that we also have a renewed interest in the outdoors. You know, people want to experience the outdoors. And finally, as I think the last couple of seasons have proved exemplarily, we have very rigorous winters. So if you're cooped up inside your house for months at a time, and all of a sudden it's nice and sunny outside, what do you want to do? You want to go out and enjoy the outdoors. And typically, the ones that are more in the foremost of your mind, well, I've heard of this. I want to go visit this park. So obviously, everyone has had the same idea.
And is there a fix to this? Is it a matter of staffing, or if there were more people?
There isn't an easy fix. There isn't a silver bullet. There are some actions that we can take both as tourist academics, tourist practitioners, members of the media, and members of the public that we can do. Among them, first and foremost, to inform and educate visitors. You know, call ahead. Look at the social media presence of these different sites. You're going to find a section somewhere that says, you know, peak times are... And I understand it doesn't work for everyone's schedule, but just that phone call, hey, how's the park looking? Or if you're driving there, a good rule of thumb, you know, if the overflow lots are 2/3 full, I might drive to the next destination.
If you have to wait in line just to get into the parking lot, it's not a good sign, right?
It's not a good sign. And obviously, we want you to visit. I don't want to discourage visitors by any stretch of the imagination. But at the same time, we want you to have a good time. We want you to experience the park. We want you to experience nature as it's meant to be in its pristine state. And at the same time, we don't want any permanent damage to what is a beautiful, beautiful part of the country.
And it's a conundrum a little bit, right?
Because it certainly is.
I think we love to go to outdoor attractions. And I think when there's so many, when you're in a place like a national park and there's so many other people, sometimes that kind of kills the point of being there.
Doesn't it? It does. It kind of kills the joy of being there. You know, the loneliness of the outdoors, the quiet enjoyment of nature, certainly. So what else can we do?
Right. So let's get to the education, because you have a list of other places that we could go
list,
to.
I'm only going to mention one or two. I'm thinking of the patience of our listeners. We want to encourage visitors to stay tonight. We live in a state where it's easy and it's comfortable to drive just about anywhere within a day. So what happens is that in a 24-hour period, you're going to have peak times between 10 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the evening. Well, guess what? Everyone else has had the same idea. So how about instead of just going for the day, just plan that two-day getaway, maybe during the week, play hooky. I didn't say that. If the dean or provost is hearing, I never said that. But spend 2 days rather than one. We want to turn excursionists, those who only visit for a day, into tourists. It's great for the local economy. It's going to be great for you. You have that lovely breakfast using farm fresh, naturally sourced products from the local farm. You wake up bright and early and then you visit the attraction and then you are a lot more relaxed. You're going to enjoy the park or the natural area in its pristine shape. We also want to regulate, and now I'm speaking more to practitioners, we want to regulate the number of visitors. There is a point beyond when we're coming very, very close to the carrying capacity of a natural area where we say, well, look, we're going to allow X number of visitors per hour. And it may come a point, and I think the Starved Rock may be getting there where we actually limit the number of visitors. Where we say, no, beyond this point, we can't allow more visitors per day.
Do they do that, do they do that at the Grand Canyon?
They do. They do. Certainly. They do it in a variety of national parks. In fact, all 10 of the most visited national parks, they all have those regulations. They count the number of visitors every day.
Of cars that are coming in.
Cars, and now they've gotten to the point where they count the number of people, especially if the trails are being used, because the heavy usage of the trail gets to a certain point where you actually have to limit, say that we have 5,000 people or 4,000 people in the park. Beyond that, the damage done becomes irreversible or becomes very costly to reverse. Mm-hmm. We also want to turn visitors into volunteers. Do you love that park? Awesome. You know what? Donate your time. Donate your effort. And your appreciation, the time that you're going to have to actually enjoy that park is going to be even better.
So what do you mean by that, by volunteers?
We have a immense deficit in knowledgeable staff in our natural areas. DNR is certainly doing the very best that they can, but they're short-staffed. So if you live close to a natural area that you enjoy, maybe you can lead that high school tour. Maybe you can donate your time and welcome visitors and show them perhaps your favorite part of the park. And all of that is most welcome. And what it does is it gives the visitor an insight that they didn't necessarily have. It turns them into advocates for these natural areas. And that grows into all part of educating visitors and making them aware that these natural resources, they are here for our enjoyment, certainly. But we're not really owners of the land. We're more like stewards, right? And obviously, we want to preserve that enjoyment, not just for us, but for future generations.
My guest is our unofficial tour guide to all things Illinois, Nuno Ribeiro, who teaches in the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism at the U of I. He's here with me in Urbana to talk about a couple other locations. And there are two in particular that are pretty renowned that get as much attention even as Starved Rock.
That's right. Absolutely.
Let's start with Cahokia.
So Cahokia Mounds is the site of the largest pre-Columbian settlement in North America. It is magnificent. It's one of the 26 World Heritage Sites granted by UNESCO to the United States. And although it's very famous, the number of visitors is actually quite small.
So before we get to what it's like when you go there, can you tell us a little bit more about what we know about the people of Cahokia? Because that's a bit of a mystery, right?
It is. We have tidbits of information. So it's at the confluence of certain bodies of water. So it makes that land extremely fertile. And it also makes it ideal for...
Can you remind us which bodies of water?
The Mississippi, the Illinois, and the Missouri rivers. So obviously, the confluence of these three bodies of water make not only the land eminently fertile and attractive to populations at that period, but it makes it a great point of communication between different tribes. And what we had was basically an incredibly evolved society. This is in pre-Columbian times that developed these types of structures or mounds that were used for a variety of things, from observation to burial sites and whatnot. And it just flourished. And somehow we think it might be a little bit related to a flood that might or might not have occurred. It might have happened, something with intertribal warfare.
So this is like 1,500 years ago?
Just about.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, it sort of kind
it just
of disappeared.
Disappeared.
Not quite overnight, but it's almost something like it of the X-Files, which is really, really interesting for historians and tourism academics such as myself. But it's worth the visit. The amount of history contained in that particular site is just absolutely incredible.
Now, your one caveat is it's a kind of a hard thing to visit on your own without someone who knows about it.
Please stop by the visitor center and take the tour. Otherwise, it's just going to look like a bunch of hills. Very beautiful hills, as far as the eye can see. Magnificent, yes. But you need to read a little bit to really understand and recognize the historical importance of that particular site.
And it would be actually, and I know as we think about, we've done past conversations about Cahokia and having people there, it certainly would help to have a lot more people visiting this area knowing more about it.
It would help immensely, absolutely. It's an area that certainly could use it.
Another location you have that's kind of on the opposite end of a spectrum from ancient ruin, even though there's nothing there, is a garden.
Right. So the Anderson Japanese Gardens are magnificent. This is in Rockford, Illinois. They're one of my favorite destinations. And just in case you don't know, they have one of the most beautiful outside tea houses that I've seen in my lifetime. They're absolutely magnificent. The garden themselves, they're just this oasis of tranquility. And who should perform the tea ceremonies when they do occur in a tea house? Our very own delightful staff from right here at Japan House at UIUC. So Here's a plug for them.
Okay.
You should definitely go visit them. They are magnificent gardens, and part of the gardens are ADA accessible, which is fairly uncommon in North America. If you are mobility impaired, if you necessitate the use of a walker or of a wheelchair, there are parts of the garden that were built specifically with that in mind so that you can enjoy that specific part of the gardens.
And why do you think people don't know as much throughout the state? And I think our listeners in the Rockford area probably would know a lot more about Anderson Japanese Gardens versus other parts of the state or Cahokia. Do you think it's because they don't get as much social media attention
it
or conversation?
Be. I mean, you know, they're, again, eminently Instagrammable. I know that the most number of likes that I ever got in my Instagram feed was when I took a photo in the Anderson Japanese Gardens. But it might be just because they're known only to a select group of people within a certain geographic radius. It might be because of that.
And then getting to the idea of other hikes or other state parks, we know Shawnee National Forest. We know Starved Rock. What are some other parks throughout the state that people can think about visiting
this summer? The Mississippi Palisades State Park in Savannah, Illinois, that's in the northwest Illinois near the border with Iowa, is just beautiful. Literally, you are likely to have the park to yourself, maybe not after this radio talk, but it is absolutely beautiful. It's fairly unknown to most of the Illinois public. There's about 10 to 15 miles of trails that you can hike. It's absolutely gorgeous. Another area is the Cache River Natural Area. This is in Belknap, Illinois.
This is near
Shawnee, right. And what a lot of people don't know, typically when we hear about the Shawnee National Forest, we think the Garden of the Gods, but there's a host of other local parks. So if you've taken the day and you're set on seeing the Garden of the Gods and you get there, you know, and maybe there's a lot of cars, you know, the overflow parking lot is full or close to full. You know what? Drive a couple of miles, see one of these other parks, stay the night, and then early, bright and early the next morning, then go visit a Garden of the Gods for sure.
Also in southern Illinois, you have another location near Carbondale.
I do. I have the Pomona Natural Bridge in Pomona, Illinois, which is absolutely beautiful. It's not the name of the park, but how you'll get there. If you ask for that, it says rock formation. It's basically a 14-foot natural bridge. Again, for those of you who are on social media, this is the eminent. This is the best selfie you can possibly get in your lifetime. And lastly, the Grandview Drive, which is a half-mile stretch of road that goes through Peoria Heights in Peoria, Illinois, and that is absolutely beautiful. And you wouldn't know it's there. It's sort of tucked away. And you have to punch in your GPS, Grandview Drive, and if you drive too fast, you're going to miss it. It forces you to slow down, to appreciate nature, to appreciate your surroundings. And there's nothing but park benches scattered here and there.
So a couple, we'll have a list. Nuno has created this great list for us. We will have this list on our website at 21stshow.org. We will tweet out this list as well. With Cahokia Mounds, Anderson Japanese Garden, then a couple state parks in a couple areas. We will have all of this at our website so you can remember them. Maybe we'll have, Nuno, maybe we should put your Instagrams of these on our website.
Sure.
I want to thank Nuno Ribeiro with the University of Illinois Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism for being with us. Thanks for being
My
here.
My absolute pleasure.
That's actually all the time we have for today. As I mentioned, our website is a great source of information, 21stshow.org. We'll have this entire list up there. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farha is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.